Nếu như
globalization, to a large extent, is actually removing responsibility from people within their own locality to take care of themselves.
We know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules.
We traveled 1,000 miles in an hour and a half. We have traveled through whole areas of existence which we have not necessarily gained. We will pop into a Hindu village, but we won't know a damn thing about that Hindu village.
If you push that all the way, you see, what it means is that we will increasingly tend to inhabit all of these areas in depth simultaneously.
Južna hemisfera. Vsako drugo sredo poročamo o južni polobli. Točno o poldan.
Ne bomo zbežali v Evropo v plavajočih smrtonosnih pastih. Ne bomo z žalostjo zažgali src naših mater. Ne bodo nas ribe pojedle. Ponovno bomo zgradili Alžirijo. Pozdravljeni, poslušate APR intervju na valovih Radija Študent. Tokrat bomo govorili o Alžiriji s svobodnim novinarjem Sofijanom Filipom Nasarjem. Njegova področja zanimanja so Alžirija, Tunizija in Egipt, kjer je tudi živel, medtem ko je zdaj nastanjen v Berlinu. Ujeli smo ga na Transborder Summer Camp v francoskem Nantu, natančneje v ZAD de Notre Dame de Londres, za skvotanem območju, kjer se aktivisti že desetletja bojujejo proti izgradnji načrtovanega letališča. Vprašali smo ga, ali nam lahko poskuša orisati Alžirijo, največjo afriško državo, ki pa je obenem ena izmed najmanj poseljenih, saj je obsežen del njenega teritorija Sahara. Alžirija je eno glavnih pribežališč migrantov iz Zahodne Afrike in njihova odskočna deska čez Mediteransko moro. Obenem pa deluje kot zunanja meja EU in kot taka tudi deportira Zahodne Afričane, ki v Evropi niso dobrodošli. Več o tem lahko izveste v zadnjem prispevku oddaje Južna hemisfera, do katerega bo v spletni objavi tokratnega intervjuja vodila tudi povezava. V Alžiriji se od februarja dalje vsak torek in petek odvijajo najmnožičnejši protesti v zadnjih 20 letih. 2. aprila so privedli do konca 20-letne vladavine predsednika Abdelaziza Bouteflike. Prvo poglavje. Antikolonializem in nafta. Sofijan Nasser pove, katere so glavne teme, pri katerih lažje razumemo trenutno dogajanje v Alžiriji.
So we have two issues that might be a key aspect, like that might be key aspects to understand the current situation in Algeria, politically, socially, and economically. One is colonization, of course, and the other one is petrol, oil. So the way how the Algerian economy is working. Colonization is important in that sense, as Algeria fought for its independence in the 50s and gained independence in 1962. And in the first, let's say, 10-15 years after independence, Algeria had a very very interesting foreign policy, because they were supporting other movements in Africa, they were supporting other independence movements in Asia, they were even supporting the Black Panther in the US. Algiers became the mecca of revolutionaries. There's a documentary movie with this title, telling more about this phase. So Algeria had historically this anti-colonial approach after its independence. The interesting thing is today, the protest movement turned from a movement that was opposing the candidacy of the president Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who wanted to present himself again for a fifth term. So this was the initial idea and the initial major slogan of the protest. This turned into reframing the whole national discourse in claiming that the current struggle today is linked to decolonization, claiming that or saying that we were never decolonized, because when the French left, a local elite emerged and basically replaced the French. So we're still suppressed, we're still oppressed by an elite. It's not a French elite anymore, it's an Algerian elite. And this is something that we find in also leftist discourses of people like Frantz Fanon, who were writing about this in the 50s and 60s, so leftist political theory, that like a certain class is basically replacing...
Yeah, the compared, like in Latin America, the compared
exactly,
elite. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is something that became... And the interesting thing is that this was always like a narrative of the left, but it was never something that mobilized people massively. But during the protests now, because protests were ongoing since February, so for months. So in May, after 3 or 4 months of protests, less and less people joined protests. Police repression became oppression became more arrests of activists and protesters and all of this. And you got the impression that the wind is changing and the movement is more under pressure and more cornered by the regime. But on 5th of July, which coincided, it was a Friday, which is National Independence Day in Algeria. The first time for 5 weeks, we had countrywide mass protests again because of this new narrative that is framing or basically blaming the... saying that the current regime is simply an extension of colonization. Mm. So this is something that is important from a leftist perspective, but it's interesting to see that now we have this as a major narrative in the streets. The second thing is economy. Algeria is a rentier state. The Algerian economy is dependent on oil, which means that in times of a high oil price, you can put this money into society, you can channel protests, you can try to... So the ruling class is always trying to channel opposition by this. They're basically buying off parts of society to be able to maintain political stability, to maintain privileges of a certain ruling class. And the problem of an oil-dependent economy, like Algeria is a 100% rentier state. There's some industry, there's some agriculture, but 98% of foreign reserves, of foreign currency income, comes from one company. It's the state-owned oil and gas producer, Sonatrach.
Completely owned or state-owned?
98% of all...
how much is it state-owned?
100%. Okay. 100%. So that company belongs to the state 100%. But it doesn't employ people. Like, roughly 100,000 people work in the oil industry, not more. So as you don't have any, as you don't have any competitive industry, the agricultural sector is fucked. You have structurally a very high unemployment rate. So on that moment, when the oil price goes down, the government is not able to buy off people anymore. It's not possible. So, but this is a problem in a lot of states that are, a lot of economies that are based on rents. So, oil. Or the income of exporting oil is a structural problem for an economy. So there's only one state that managed to deal with this problem, which is Norway. So in Norway, Statoil is a partially government-owned company, but all the profits from Statoil don't go to the state budget; they go to a fund. Mm. So the money is blocked. So the government is not able to. The government is not able to access this money, so they have to make sure that people have jobs. In Algeria, this is not the case. So, and for the government, which is swimming in money in good times, it's easier for the government to import washing machines, to import food, to import cars, than to try to establish a local industry. Mm. This is a structural problem, which is also now an issue because struggles for political power and for political influence, there might be initially some there might be initially political fights for certain ideological ideas, but they turn always into a fight for resources. So you have new political groups emerging, they get included in the ruling class, so their only objective at that point is to get a piece of the cake. This is a structural problem that will also that will also come back at one point. So Algeria is not able to just fix this problem within a couple of weeks or a couple of months of protests. It's very difficult to overcome the structural problem.
The protests at any point take an economic turn in the sense of articulation of economic policies or even like, something like that? Or is it mostly like for political freedoms? And
It's not only for political freedoms, it's about inequalities. It's about a fair share. It's about sharing the oil resources. It's not about overcoming the dependency on oil. It's about social issues. It's about so this oil money is invested in Algiers, in the capital, and in major cities, and they're building infrastructure. But in more marginalized areas, people don't have housing. No streets, no train connections. For years now, we have a lot of local protests where people are blocking highways, overland highways, because they didn't have water for a week. And the local protests where they burn tires and basically block a road for a week, just to raise awareness.
Drugo poglavje. Razvoj gospodarstva, gibanje za neodvisnost in politična vloga islama. Kako je ekonomska zgodovina pripeljala do tega, da je alžirska ekonomija v tolikšni meri odvisna od izvoza nafte?
The economy turned into an oil economy in the 60s. So right after independence, the French had local production and agriculture. It was the agricultural sector in Algeria was very productive, and it worked very well because it served how the French called it, the homeland. It served France, and it happened in a different economical context. So when the oil industry became stronger and stronger, the government started already with importing food a lot, and they tried to overcome this by a strategy that a lot of countries in Africa and Asia try to overcome this oil problem in importing ready-made factories. There was a strategy where a lot of governments, also from the non-alignment movement, were putting hope in to overcome structural deficiencies of an economy. So they import a factory, they just build it, contract a foreign company that is building it up. They some trainings for the staff to run the factory, and then they start producing whatever, cars or iron or refineries or any kind of this stuff. But it didn't work. It failed completely.
Why?
You just can't do this because you don't have this chain of. So when you have a ready-made factory, you import it, but then one piece breaks. You need spare parts. So then you need again to import it. And when you then have issues with the country, problems with that country that you were buying that factory from, and it tells you no, sorry, we will not deliver it, the factory is worthless. So it happened because of this, because of the market wasn't ready for this kind of thing, and also because personnel you couldn't find proper educated people. It didn't work in just you train 10 engineers and then two of those 10 train others. It didn't work. Because you don't have the educational infrastructure, you don't have the experience in an industrialized country like France or Germany or the US.
Okay.
You have a different.
Okay, and this is the diversification, like to try. Like this importing happened before the 60s, and then in the 60s.
No, that happened in the 60s and 70s. It happened under President Wadi Boumediene.
Okay.
He was in power from 1965 until he died in 1979.
Okay.
So he tried this and it failed.
Okay.
So already at that time they were aware of that we need a diversification.
Mm.
It didn't work. In the 80s, the oil price went down, so social protests started. Socially motivated protests because of access to water, but also politically motivated. So we had the same situation in the 80s, like the situation today, and in the 80s is similar. Oil price goes down, no money anymore, so you can't buy off, you can't channel political and social opposition and demands of people who ask for a fair share. So it ended up in a revolt, in a democratic reform that was hijacked by Islamist movements. They won elections, which was considered a provocation by the security apparatus, who staged a military coup and turned the country into a battlefield. So the result of that was 10 years of civil war. After the oil price went up again in 2000-2001, the government finally was able to pay foreign debts, become fiscally independent from institutions like the World Bank or the IMF, and they were able to invest in the economy. But they invested in infrastructure, but not in creating jobs. So that was their strategy. And in 2014, in December 2014, the oil price dropped again, went down from around $100 per barrel to less than 50. So the state budget declined by 50%.
Yeah, but when you say about the infrastructure, what do you mean? Like roads, bridges, electricity, water? Or do you mean like schools, hospitals, like social stuff?
All of it, actually, like highways, airports, but also social housing. But the problem was that they were not fast enough. They couldn't catch up with like population growth. And it was managed by the state, but in a bad way. So there was corruption also in social housing projects, and there was a lot of corruption in building highways and other infrastructure. So there's the most popular example is the East-West Highway. They built a highway from the Moroccan border to the Tunisian border, and that project was run by Ali Haddad, a businessman who is affiliated to the president, Bouteflika, and his people. So, and there was a lot of corruption involved in that. So a lot of money disappeared. And when the oil price went down, it was too late. So they also built mosques and there were projects that tried to, again, foster the state grip on religion, using it as a tool to keep people quiet. In a lot of Arab countries, after decolonization, the regimes cracked down massively on the most popular opposition movements, which were communist parties or like socialist parties. So that also happened in Algeria, that happened in Egypt, that happened in Tunisia, that happened in Iran. In Iran, it was the Tudeh party that was under the Shah rule, prosecuted. In an unprecedented way.
Yeah.
The same happened in Algeria and Egypt. But when you destroy any kind of opposition like this, but also liberal and democratic parties, neoliberal parties, there was also a crackdown against capitalists, parties that had a clear economic policy in capitalism, free market, all of this.
Oh yeah, but that's,
so, but
that's
communists, like communists at that time were the most important, most influential groups. So the regimes cracked down on them, with the result that the only place where you could basically speak and talk about political things for opposition figures were mosques. Which led to the fact that these Islamist movements that emerged step by step were the only ones that had a place for discussion. They had a place to meet, and they met every Friday, Friday prayer. So they are in the mosque anyways, and the state cannot touch religion in that world because it's impossible to do that.
But this like the crackdown happened after the Mecca revolutionaries or
at the same time.
Oh, okay.
At the same time. So while Algeria was like hosting the South African ANC or the American Black Panther, at the same time they were cracking down on local opposition.
What's your general stance towards the Algerian independence movement? I mean, in the context of what happened after and how you see it now retroactively, or how what could they do there? I mean, probably it was heterogeneous, but yeah, what are the currents within it?
I mean, it is unquestionable that it had to happen. But the problem is the way how it happened. And it was basically, it was physically a takeover from outside, because the FLN, the independence movement, its political leadership was in Cairo. Its armed leadership was in Algeria, was operating from inside Algeria. But military-wise, they were beaten. So independence happened because of political issues, and not because they won a war against the French army. So within Algeria, the ALN, so the armed wing of the FLN, was not able to operate properly anymore. They were successfully prosecuted and hunted down by the French colonial army. But what the FLN and the ALN did, there were refugee camps in Morocco and in Tunisia. And in these camps, several generals, Algerian generals, who served in the French army before, they trained people from these camps. So they basically set up an army outside of Algeria that was like standing and waiting. And when the French left the country, those two armies from Morocco and Tunis marched to Algiers and took over. And even at that time, you had within the FLN, so the FLN had the military wing and it had the political wing. But the five, or like the political leaders who were based in Cairo, were captured by the French army in an intelligence operation. So they were in prison in France for years. So they were weakened. So the military wing took over, and there were political assassinations against political leaders in the late 50s already. So even at that time, within the FLN, they were like fighting for how do we deal with politics in that moment when we gain independence.
And what was the political project, I mean, or the political imaginary of the political wing that was, I mean, in Cairo and later in prison?
It was from the beginning close to the non-alignment movement. But this movement, the FLN, the Front Libération Nationale, it's a front, so it's not a, which means that it's a very broad coalition of several groups. So they always included leftists, but also liberals and conservatives. So it was a heterogeneous movement. It was not any, it was not clear we go, we will, and ideologically they were not homogeneous, not at all.
Tretje poglavje – mednarodni odnosi. Če smo prej govorili o gibanju za neodvisnost, kakšno je stanje neodvisnosti Alžirije danes? V kakšnih odnosih je z ostalimi državami po svetu in v regiji?
I would say Algeria still like definitely has a certain kind of independence from international, like also from France, but France and other. So I would not consider Algeria as a classical like third world country that is completely 100% dependent on some Western countries. But there is a dependency economically and politically as well. But Algeria tried to follow a certain policy that makes it more independent from Europe. So what they did, for example, in the last 15, 20 years under Bouteflika's rule is they faded away a little bit from France as the traditional economic partner. Today, for example, Italy is the biggest trade partner of Algeria. And politically, they kept their relations to France, but they also opened up relations to Rome, to Moscow, to China, and they started playing those superpowers against each other. One example, I think it was 2004, 2005, Algeria started to, also because suddenly they had a lot of money, so they wanted to modernize the army and the whole security apparatus. So what did they do? They started negotiations with Russia on a huge weapon deal. So they got some planes and some ships, some vessels, and they tested them. And then they said, sorry, we don't take the planes. We don't like them. They're not good. So they went to France and negotiated with them. So showing the superpowers, okay, if you don't make us a good price, we just go somewhere else. And this is something that they did a lot. So they're basically maintaining relations with China and also always with open negotiations. They're negotiating with China and with Germany and with the US and with Russia at the same time.
And what about the relations within Africa? Algeria to other states in Africa?
That is something that changed a lot since the Civil War in the 90s. Since then, Algeria is a very closed country. So they stopped funding of international independence movements that happened in the 60s and 70s, stopped, and Algeria became a country that is very isolated in a way that it's very difficult for Algerians to get visas for other countries and to leave, but it's also very difficult for others, including Europeans, to go to Algeria. They basically close the border for everyone. The Algerian army is, which is an article in the constitution that is stipulating that the Algerian army is not allowed to operate abroad. And they're maintaining a very strong military because it's a very big country, and because of the terrorist threat in the Sahel region, and because of the history in the 90s and the civil war, they massively invested a lot of money in the army. But relations to African countries were complicated. For example, let's break it down to the regional level. The Maghreb region, which includes Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Mauritania, and maybe Libya. But the relations of these four or five countries are very weak. Globally, it's the less integrated regional region economically. So the trade these five countries do with each other is basically zero. The Moroccan-Algerian border is closed since the mid-90s. Politically, those two ruling classes use each other to channel local national opposition or protest movements. So the situation is blocked, although it would make completely sense to work together economically. Morocco has a lot of agriculture, but no oil. Algeria has a big problem with its agricultural sector, needs to import agricultural stuff, but does it from Europe and not from Morocco.
And why? Why?
For political reasons.
But how did it come to this?
This is also something that has to do with decolonization, because the major problem Morocco and Algeria had with each other is the West Sahara. A country that Morocco occupied and claims that it's part of Moroccan territory, and Algeria is supporting the Sahrawi, so the independence movement for West Sahara. And their government, the exiled Sahrawi government, is based in Tindouf in Algeria. So they are hosting them. So this political issue is the main reason for the political blockade between Algiers and Rabat.
And why does Algeria support the Western Sahara independence movement?
It's something I'm honestly not... I can just guess. So this is something like...
I had need for this. I would have need to dig in the 60s and 70s, and it might also have to do with the decolonization and with the support Algeria was giving to independence movements, because when that happened, they right away supported the Sahrawis. In 75, Morocco occupied Western Sahara, and a lot of the Sahrawis went to Algeria, and they hosted them right away. And right away, they gave them political backing. So maybe that was like one of the last phases of when Algeria like actually supported movements that are trying to gain independence. It might be, it's for sure it's one reason, I'm not sure if it's the major reason. There are other people who are claiming the reason for this is like Algeria wanted to have access to the Atlantic Ocean and to the natural resources the Western Sahara has.
Is geopolitics a discussion in the protest movement, or is it internal mostly?
No, this is something that is very visible in the streets. It's very visible in the streets. Foreign interference in Algeria is a no-go, an absolutely a no-go. And this, it was quite interesting when, you know, all these Western think tanks that are affiliated to governments, when there's an uprising somewhere, they come up with reports and with recommendations. And you have think tanks like, in Germany, it's the SWP. It's a foundation based in Berlin. You have a lot of like US-funded institutions like this who are publishing reports, and the last chapter follows recommendations. And all of them were pretty clear, like the first reports that popped up in March and April, all of them were pretty clear in saying, in recommending for their governments to stay out of what's happening there right now. Because in one, after Bouteflika announced, or after Bouteflika's people announced that he will not run again for president, the French president Emmanuel Macron made a statement endorsing this step, saying it's a good concession. The government reacted to the popular demands in the streets, so it's very well that the government, the Algerian government, is now reacting and is stepping back. The reaction in the streets was like, this is foreign interference. And there was one slogan that was put up in protests and became very famous, because it was also like, it was a bit a funny one. And so there was the slogan saying, be careful, Macron. There are 7 million Algerians in France. So saying directly, you do not meddle with our internal affairs right now. You do not meddle with our revolt. Stay away. So, and this is something which is interesting. It's the rhetoric of the government, but it's also the way how in society people are like. It's something that is. It's something you find everywhere in society and in political life. Foreign interference is a problem. There is foreign interference, of course, but even if the government, the Algerian government, cooperates with a certain country in any kind of way, for example, when it comes to migration, Algeria is cooperating with the European Union. But they're very smart in framing it in a way that it doesn't look like that Algeria plays the watchdog for the EU. They're framing it differently. They're saying the European Union closes its border, with the result that now in Algeria we have a lot of Africans because they used Algeria as a transit country, and now they're stuck because they can't go further. So now suddenly we have a lot of West Africans in our country, but we don't want them. Like, you closed the border, it's your problem. You fucked up you destroyed the local economies in Western Africa. So it's Europe that is responsible for this, not us. So we don't want them. So this is how they also justified the deportation campaigns of Africans. They said, okay, Europe doesn't leave us any other choice. We have to do it.
Četrto poglavje. Migracije. Mama, Nekateri od Alžircev in Alžirk, ki zapuščajo svojo državo, pripotujejo po balkanski ruti in skozi Slovenijo. Mnogi izmed njih v Sloveniji zaprosijo tudi za azil. Kolikor nam je znano, je v zadnjih letih dobila status azilanta ena oseba, kar je v skladu tudi številkami iz ostalih držav Magreba. Kaj pomeni slabo življenje v Alžiriji in kako je to prispevalo k protestom, znotraj katerih se ponovno poraja javni prostor?
The motivation for Algerians to leave is complex. The majority, I would say, is leaving for socio-economic reasons, but it's also political reasons and something that is that predominantly pops up in this discourse is the bad life, like the whole life situation. It's a very conservative country. It's a very closed society, I would say, family-based. There is not really a public space. There's not cultural events, there's, and like, parts of this is the result of the civil war in the 90s. So you had you have a revolt, you have democratic elections. Unfortunately, the Islamists won the elections because they could lobby and mobilize and were able to put together a political party that was able to win elections. And the society was already conservative, but because of the 10 years of civil war, afterwards, in 1999, when Bouteflika became the president of Algeria, he started a coalition government, his party, and moderate Islamists. So you had not the radical Islamists that were involved in the civil war in the 90s, but you had a moderate Islamist party trying to please some parts of the society, the conservative part of the society. So. And if this and this became a very, very, very important thing that so it was still a problem with like finding cultural events in even in Algiers. We're talking about the capital of Algeria with like 3.5-4 million inhabitants, and you barely have concerts, you barely have like theater plays or cinemas. Like there is no infrastructure for this. Also, this is also because of the civil war, because those Islamists, those radical Islamists, attacked journalists, foreigners, musicians were killed, so cultural spaces had to shut down. So when you're young and you can't go to the cinema, you can't go to the theater, you can't even, you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, but you don't have a place to go because it's a family-based society, so you live with your family. So you never have a private life. You never you're not able to flourish. You're not able to have a little bit of adventurous life. It's not possible. It's not there. Which is also maybe a reason why today in this movement you had so many people going to the streets, because it was a party in the streets. People went to the streets and they met their friends, they met new people, they could exchange phone numbers with girls and boys. So, and even old people were like telling me this and saying, like, I think one of the main reasons why people are protesting Seoul for such a long time is also because it's a public space finally. It's reclaiming the street and it's redefining the public space. So the fact that the society was like affected by the civil war in this way, the government's reaction was like, okay, we have to strengthen conservative discourses, we have to strengthen this kind of thing. So they kind of try to use it in a way that, okay, people are conservative anyway, so this is what we have to do now. But they missed the fact that the population is a very young population, and also through this like internet revolution thingy, people are connected. So people know what's happening in Europe, people see pictures of their friends who are already in France, who go to a concert, who go to a bar, who go to a coffee shop, and sit there with like three girls, and it's like, from a male perspective, and there is no problem. In Algeria, it would be a problem. So people are also leaving for this, just to enjoy time a little bit, and to, you're a teenager, you want to go out and meet friends and discuss. But in Algeria, you can't. Like bars in Algiers, we're not only talking about this aspect of it. You don't see them. You don't, like, they're hidden. You have some bars, but they're hidden. So coffee shops close at 8. So at 8 p.m., there's no life in the streets anymore. People go home. So Algerian migration towards Europe is nothing new. That was something already after Algerian independence. A lot of people went to France for work, but it was easier. So that is nothing new at all. In Western Algeria, also to Spain. So there's close relations between Western Algeria and the Spanish society. It's nothing new at all. But since the oil price went down in 2014, more and more people started leaving for economic reasons because inflation went up, subsidies went down, so food, fuel, water became more expensive. What you already had before was like that male young people were like migrating to France or Spain to work or to just escape that society. Since 2016, I would say, there's more and more a shift that affects the whole society. So today, you have much more women who leave, and even whole families. So whole families, sometimes a couple with a young child, or even a whole family, like parents, their children, but also grandparents, buy a boat together and an engine and go to Spain or Italy. And sometimes parents don't do this for themselves. They do it that their kids have a future. And for whatever reason, it was very easy for Algerians in the past to just travel to Turkey and then take the Balkan route. But what was also always an issue was just going directly by boat. And it was always possible, but in the past also Algerians like went to Morocco or like to Libya and did it from there after the policy of the EU of externalizing the border became more and more evident and borders were basically closed. That was the moment when Algerians also like more went to Italy and Spain directly from Algerian territory. And there's also an issue that, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's encouraged by the government, but the government is not really prosecuting those. There's laws in place that are criminalizing this, so you're not allowed to leave the national territory irregularly. But law enforcement is not really going after Algerians. So when the Algerian Navy intercepts a boat, and they find 20 Algerians, they bring them back to Algeria. They also start formally a prosecution, but usually they pay a fine and leave the prison after a week. That was like something that was ongoing for years. No, but the government knew that if they incarcerate all of those people, it will fuel more opposition and it will piss off people. So this is why they kind of let it happen. It's differently with the transit migration. So people from Senegal or Ghana or Togo who transit through Algeria, but then are stuck and then also try to take a boat from Algeria, that's something else. The Algerian security apparatus considers this as human trafficking, and those people who are involved in that are prosecuted. Which means that if you're a smuggler, so you're smuggling people or you're in any way involved in this, you're selling engines, but you're selling engines to Africans. You're prosecuted. If you sell it to Algerians, there's no problem.
Trenutno se alžirska država ukvarja z vzpostavitvijo pogojev za nove predsedniške volitve, saj so bile tiste 4. julija odpovedane. Pri tem naj bi pomagala 6-članska komisija za nacionalni dialog, ki jo je imenoval začasni predsednik Alžirije Abdelkader Ben Salah. Protesti vseeno zahtevajo njegov odstop, saj je del stare vladajoče klike povezane z Buteflikom. To isto kliko se je lotil čistiti tudi sodni sistem, ki je zaradi suma korupcije začel preiskovati visoke uradnike in gospodarstvenike, med njimi tudi dva bivša premijeja. Ben Salah pa je pred kratkim zamenjal ministra za pravosodje, verjetno prav v odziv na te preiskave. Na protestniški tapeti je med drugim tudi general Ahmed Gaid Salah, de facto najmočnejši človek v državi, ki trenutno vodi vojska. Salah je sicer podprl protestniško gibanje, a obenem diktira njegovo represijo z aretacijami in cestnimi blokadami protestnikov. Trenutno dogajanje v Alžiriji gotovo velja spremljati, saj, kot je izjavil bivši vladni minister Abdelaziz Rahabi za New York Times, umaknili smo predsednika, ne da bi ga izgnali, kot se je zgodilo v Tuniziji, ne da bi ga zaprli, kot se je zgodilo v Egiptu, in ne da bi ga ubili, kot se je zgodilo v Libiji. Ne pravite, da gredo stvari narobe.
Globalization, to a large extent, is actually removing responsibility from people within their own locality to take care of themselves.
We know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules.
We traveled 1,000 miles in an hour and a half. We have traveled through whole areas of existence which we have not necessarily gained. We will pop into a Hindu village, but we won't know a damn thing about that Hindu village.
If you push that all the way, you'll see what it means is that we will increasingly tend to inhabit all of these areas in depth simultaneously.
Južna hemisfera. Vsako drugo sredo poročamo o južni polobli. Točno o poldan.
You don't.